you to please take your seats because we're going to begin. Oh, that was good. Because you see, the panelists are all ready to go. They very kindly pay attention to me, for which I'm very thankful. And so let's get started. And again, we've got some more seats up here. We may take some of you around to fill these up. This is going to be a great panel where we're going to talk about crisis. And let me just say a word about why this is so important. When I cut my teeth on these issues, I was transitioning from being a BBC reporter to an NGO worker during the big famine in Ethiopia in 1984 and 85. People kept telling me development wasn't possible because this country was in crisis. And the fact of the matter was, is that people were still pursuing development. The international community wasn't. But people never stopped trying to improve their lives. What we have this morning is a terrific panel with a great moderator to talk about how we need to understand the connections between crisis and conflict and poverty alleviation. Now, as you know, we will move after the panel to table discussions, and what we're going to be asking you to think about there is solutions. So as you're listening, think about solutions and creative ideas that can be brought to the fore to impact the kinds of challenges our panelists are going to talk about. You also have note cards on your tables. If you have questions as they're speaking, write them out, pass them to your table facilitators, who are the brilliant people at the computers. And with that, I would like to turn over to a very skilled moderator, a woman who herself knows the issues and a good friend of mine, Tara Sonnenschein, to get us started.
Thank you very much, Gail. And let me begin by having all of us, I think, thank President Clinton and the CGI staff, Gail Smith, Dave Auerbach on these panels. I think they all deserve a round of applause. Thank you. Okay, let's get to work. This session is a think and do session. We are not going to have endless intellectual arguments over strategies, how to intervene in failed states, exactly when. I think we know some of the intellectual arguments. What we want to do here are solutions. The real, let's get down to fixing not just roads, but fixing futures. Not just turning on lights, but turning on minds, turning on knowledge, information. We are not about simply bandages and band-aids. I think we're looking for what will systematically change fragile states, states that have been in conflict, and people that are suffering everywhere. So I'm going to begin with a macro view, and what better person to turn to than an economist when you want a good macro view. I don't know if we've introduced all our panelists, but let me do that first. Paul Collier, how many of you have heard of the bottom billion? How many books have you sold, Paul?
30,000.
Okay, and that will be 30,300, I'm sure, by the end of today. Paul teaches, as you know, at Oxford University, and he's been a great expert for the British government on Africa, and he's been at the World Bank. And I'm going to start by asking Paul who this bottom billion is and how we're going to bring about some security for them. Paul.
Well, the bottom billion is a great spectrum of about 58 countries that have been essentially stagnant over the last three or four decades. There's no one reason why they're stagnant. There are a few systematic traps, I think. But one of the most severe is the conflict trap. And the conflict trap works like this, that poverty and stagnation greatly increase the risk of conflict. And then once you've got into conflict, that destroys the economy. It's kind of development in reverse. And when you come out of conflict, which takes many years, the risks of going back into conflict are very much heightened. On average, 40% of the countries that come out of conflict go back into it within a decade. Now, the challenge is to change that number radically. and it's feasible. And let me coin a phrase in what the real solution is. It just came to my mind, this wonderful new phrase. It's the economy, stupid. Now, in a moment, I'll discuss how, you know, how you fix these post-conflict economies, and it's a matter of breaking a few strategic bottlenecks. And that's where we move from the general to what can people actually do.
It's a terrific start. I'm going to move now over to Ashraf Ghani, who is founder and chairman of the Institute for State Effectiveness, a relatively new organization, 2005, I think, that is rethinking the relations between citizens, the state, and the market in a globalizing world. You know, he was Afghanistan's finance minister and earned the Emerging Markets Best Finance Minister Asia Award in 2003. You know, he was nominated for UN Secretary General, is that correct, in 2006. You, I have read, have been a critic of economics, at least of traditional textbook economics. So I'm going to give you a chance to be friendly, but take on your colleague to the left who just said it is economics.
On the contrary, I think it is economics. On that, we have no dispute. But the question is what Lord Keynes said. Can economists be as good as dentists? Namely, offer practical solutions. Yes. This is the problem. The question is not what. The question is how. And on the question of how, economics has failed us rather radically. There's been a double failure. It's a failure of economic thinking in major developmental institutions because they've taken fashions rather than science. And it's been the failure of developing countries that have not developed their own distinctiveness. Let's take a country that we don't associate with conflict today, that Gouverneur Marshall was arguing in 1950s that Singapore was going to explode. Of course, Singapore exploded to growth, not to conflict. But how did Singapore do it? By ignoring all the conventional economics of the day, by jumping its neighborhood. Instead of developing a closed national economy, it connected. So the issue here is need for novelty. We need to think in very novel ways and also fundamentally address the question of power. Economics at the level of textbook makes a series of assumptions that no CEO will run his business on the basis of. Let's explore the connection between economics and business. Harvard Business School is not run on the basis of economic thinking or Stanford Business School. No CEO will operate from a textbook, but developing country ministers are asked to operate on the basis of recommendations that are literally drawn from textbook. Last observation on this. The greatest difficulty I've had practically when I was in charge of an economy is that our economic colleagues are very weak on the market. The very thing that Paul is emphasizing, that it is the economy stupid, because they take the market for granted, that the market is an institution that needs to be carefully nurtured, and particularly the market in post-conflict countries. It is highly criminalized. It's an unlevel playing field, and unless we focus on the building of credible markets with credible states, we are not going to make move.
Before I let Paul respond to some of that, I want to come to Betty Bigombe, who is really an on-the-ground expert and peace negotiator who understands this at the very human level. Betty has been involved for many years, as you know, in peace negotiations in Uganda. She was a cabinet minister. Her initiatives brought together the Lord's Resistance Army and government ministers. And in 1994, she was named Uganda's Woman of the Year and is now with the United States Institute of Peace as a senior fellow. Betty, bring us from the altitude, the big forest, the macro view, to ordinary people. What are the problems you see in the countries in which you travel and work, and how does economics and some of what we've begun to hear about fit on the solutions? What are the real issues on the ground?
Thank you. Let me start by saying this, that when I was invited to be on this panel, my immediate reaction, I had just bought Paul Collier's book, The Bottom Billion. So I was reading it with a lot of excitement, and the next thing I was told, he was going to be on the same panel as myself, and I thought, oh my God, I plan to quote him all the time. So I lost that. Having said that, I've been dealing with children affected by war, but maybe let me put it this way, in that Africa's population, most of them, most countries, and I do not have statistics with me, are children or youth under 15. In my country, Uganda, 50% of the population are youth under 15. And in East Africa,
50%. One out of two
right.
citizens are under the age of 15.
Right. In the whole of East Africa is 44%. But in most cases, interventions from the international community do not target youth. And I think in particular, in post-conflict situations in particular, I think a lot of emphasis should be put on youth, because in decades, these are people who are going to take over, who are going to be the most productive members of the community. And if not enough is invested in them, then the country is lost. Now, I've seen some of the interventions by the international community, very well-intentioned interventions. Let me bring closer to what I've been dealing with, that are children that have been affected by war. And with very good intentions, some donor community come in with scholarship so that it is free education. And my country, Uganda, has free education. But when you look at the areas that have been affected by war, a lot of the children are still not benefiting from that free education. The reasons are they're so impoverished that they can't afford uniforms, textbooks, even pens. But more importantly, when you look at the girls' education, which we are talking about all the time in the Millennium Development Goal, my findings in Burundi shocked me that even with full scholarship, a lot of girls were dropping out of school, or they were repeating classes. One of the main reasons is they don't go to school in 3 or 4 days in a month when they're having their menstruation. So should we put sanitary towels be in the package for education? There's also sex abuse by the male teachers. Should we probably consider increasing the number of female teachers to provide this kind of protection? Furthermore, I have seen how children that have participated in war, these are children who are deeply scarred. They've been brutalized, but in turn they've also been very brutal to their own community. And 99.9% of them, when they come out and you ask them what they want to do in life, the first thing is they all want to go to school. And again, in here, some interventions have taken them to school. But without realizing that their needs are very different from the ordinary child that has not gone to school, that has not participated in war or affected by war. And the teachers themselves are also not prepared to deal with, they just simply do not know how to deal with these teachers, with such children. So what I'm trying to say is that the package needs to see that counseling. I'll give an example in one case where a teacher gave bad grade to a child, and he walked up to her and said, "Do you know how many people I've killed? Why did you give me bad grade?" And she screamed. The next thing is this child is expelled. Instead of trying to find out what are their real needs, how can we better address this situation? But
Yeah, let's pause there. I think you've given us a tremendous amount to build on. Ashraf, do you want to talk from the Afghanistan point of view as to what issues, similar, I'm sure, but also other issues that have come up?
Certainly. Let me first take the question of the role of the private capital. And here's a success story. $800 million of private sector investment in telecom, 2.5 million firms have been created, and within the next 2 years, another 2.5 million firms are going to be created. 70% of Afghanistan is covered now by mobile phones. What did we do to get this, and what had we to encounter? First, we had to overcome corporate greed. We had 100 mobile phones in 2002, and two major corporations, one European, one American, came and asked to be subsidized instead of play on a level playing field. Second, we had to overcome our own corruption because people wanted to make deals under the table, and that had to be prevented. Third, one had to get two essentials: risk guarantees from the United States that President Bush had to order the administration because they said Afghanistan is too risky, why should we go there? Second, Prime Minister Blair and Development Minister Clare Short made 6 of the best telecom experts in the world available to us for 6 months. On that basis, a level playing field was created. Now the largest taxpayer in Afghanistan is the telecom sector. So the entire environment need not be ready the way we say, and all the institutions need not be in place to create meaningful investment. Second, 23,000 Afghan villages today have elected leaders that have been elected on the basis of secret ballot. They've spent $240 million in the course of last 5 years. Every single village in Afghanistan is entitled on the basis of very clear criteria. And here, the key was to get the question of citizenship right. We think the poor have no views and cannot run their affairs. By contrast, they are the most adept at making choices because on a daily basis, they have to decide whether to eat or how to eat or who eats. Is it the woman or is it the men? Those decisions. So what we did in Afghanistan, and I'm proud that Minister Atmar, who was very instrumental then in implementing this program, is with us, to design a program that empowered the citizens of Afghanistan to make decisions. So a state-building project today needs to take a bottom-up approach towards community empowerment. And the key here is we have been used, because of 19th century science, to an atomistic view of the individuals. We need to rediscover social networks in communities and empower them to make decisions. Now these elected bodies are federated. And they have become the most significant lobbying group in the country for positive change. And here, again, the World Bank and a number of other organizations partnered with us to be able to make it. That was phase one, which was redistributive. Phase two is to ensure that they get power, electricity, because that is going to be a very significant driver. In phase three is that at least 80% of them should become enterprises. One has to think about new mechanisms that starts from redistribution to create the institutional and social capital, then to go to generate the financial capital. But this requires working with very different building blocks than the aid system is operated, because that view is top-down. And we need to rearrange all the stakeholders, like NGOs. NGOs as part of this program are playing a very vital role in facilitating. But we should not substitute the relation between the state and citizen to a relation either between donors and citizens or NGOs and citizens. They have different roles.
Paul, pick up on that. You say in the book, we don't have a world government to set priorities and to bring all the stakeholders. Who should set priorities? if you want it, we want to do so many things, we want to do everything, who makes those tough choices?
Well, I think the priorities have to partly come from a reflection of what are the realities on the ground. And I agree with you, Ashraf, that the textbooks are basically written about developed economies, and the characteristics of post-conflict economies are highly distinctive. I'll give you one example of a bottleneck that's usually encountered post-conflict, and that's the construction sector. Post-conflict, a lot of it is about reconstruction. The sector which provides the reconstruction is the construction sector. Now, during conflict, what are people engaged in? They're not engaged in construction, they're engaged in destruction. And so the construction sector withers away. And so after the peace settlement, you get a tidal wave of money trying to rebuild infrastructure, which needs the services of construction sector, which has withered away. And the construction sector has withered away, but together with all the skills that that sector needs. The organizations aren't there, the firms aren't there, the mundane skills that construction needs are not there. Now, not only can construction deliver infrastructure, fix the ports, fix the roads and so on, it can also deliver the jobs for the young men. That's the vital thing in getting us back to a secure peace.
Huh? Eddie, do you want to pick up on that? Because I know you've talked a lot about training and skill building.
Yes. To pick up on what Paul said is that emphasis is usually on infrastructure, which is perfectly all right, but it needs to be balanced. And youths that have been affected by war, there have also been some kind of offers in skills training. I give examples in a few countries. The girls usually, the offers in skills training is, for example, tailoring. But everybody, NGO, the World Bank, other donor community is offering training in tailoring. So you end up with thousands of tailors without clients. Sometimes training of even the young people, that is done, which is fantastic because it gives them self-esteem. It gives them hope to start to pick up the pieces of their lives and do something. But this is usually done without assessing whether what the demands are, whether they will be able to get job or can get clients or start their own small-scale enterprises. So after this training, when there are no job opportunities or they cannot set up their own small enterprises, they're just as frustrated like nothing has happened before. If we look at Middle East, I was reading somewhere, you find that one of the reasons that's fueling the war are young people who are not employed and they have no hope of, you know, there's no hope in life. And so that is the easiest thing to do. Guns give you, it's a status symbol. It gives you the power. You can feed yourself on that. So stability needs to focus on what in the next generation to be able to bring sustainable peace.
Let me ask Paul and Ashraf, both of you. I mean, one can get confused here between whether we are alleviating poverty or growing economies, and are we trying to do both at the same time, and can they be done together? Paul, and then...
Yeah. To be honest, I think... poverty alleviation has not been a good criterion by which to navigate. Poverty alleviation is an outcome of getting a growth strategy right. But really, you've got to navigate on what are the bottlenecks and how you break them. If you can break the bottlenecks, you'll bring poverty down. And so that sometimes means not directly targeting the poor, it means targeting the bottlenecks. Right? So, for example, Betty gave this great example of, as it were, unfocused, untargeted, unstrategic training. Tailors in a post-conflict environment. Right? All we need in a post-conflict environment is bricklayers, plumbers, people who can build. Every time you create some mundane skills there, you can also employ a lot of totally unskilled people. But the unskilled people on their own are useless unless they are matched with some skilled people. And so, very simple thing to do, right? Sponsor a technical college that trains up the really mundane construction skills as a first step in reconstruction. Right? Some African countries, they fail to do that. Liberia, the costs of building a school in the last year have doubled because they just march straight in to the bottleneck of there's no cement, there's no firms, there's no skills, and there's huge needs and huge money. And so the money is being dissipated in high costs instead of breaking the bottlenecks that have pushed those costs up.
To build on Paul, the first thing in a post-conflict situation is complexity. You have to balance security, politics, and development simultaneously.
Yeah.
Because without that, you really cannot create the environment for creating an economy. And in a post-conflict situation, I would not have dinner with my cabinet colleagues prior to the September 11th. A lot of them were outright criminals. But politics requires, peace requires making deals of those kinds. And it has to be recognized that there are real constraints. And second, there are global interests that make warlords your colleagues. And if that is not recognized, you're not going to get traction. Second is that the current modality of global procurement of goods and services is anti-developmental.
Because you're saying it's anti-developmental
of the local economies. The very thing that Paul is mentioning, the construction sector, is given for competitive bidding. But who comes to bid in a post-conflict environment but the most corrupt firms? So formally, you comply with criteria, but none of these developmental institutions is focused on a really cohesive agenda. It takes maximum of 6 months to train all the bricklayers, electricians, etc. It's not rocket science. That has not been done in a single post-conflict country. You need supply chain management. Singapore did this to excellence, and because of that, 96% of housing in Singapore is provided by the public sector. You need insurance. You need leasing operations. The building blocks of building an economy practically are what textbook economics in general and the developmental practices of these institutions fail to focus on. So if we can focus on those things, we can get the traction. And here comes the question of youth. I did a very large survey in Afghanistan again. You know, conflict is looming again. And I asked the people who had carried out the survey, what is the definition of a Taliban? And they said an unemployed youth. For $50, people have been blowing up bridges that have cost $500,000. And we need to focus on the youth. They don't want out. They want into the globalization process. But unless we have an agenda of creating middle classes in these places and opening up the prospect of upward social mobility, we really cannot bring peace. And that requires a double perspective, both the politics of hope and the economics of growth.
I've looked statistically at what makes a country prone to large-scale violence, and the proportion of youth is a highly significant factor. The higher the proportion of youth, when you get to 50% under 15, you're living dangerously, and that's because you've just got to deliver jobs for ordinary young people. And that does take a distinctive approach. It's not just the construction sector. There's lots more.
Let me let Betty have a closing thought, and then we're going to move into table discussions where we will ask you to stimulate discussion and really probe with some questions that we can take up after the break. So, Betty, a closing thought, and then we'll go to table questions. And Gail will explain how that will work.
Well, just picking on what Ashraf and Paul have both said in what the perception in post-conflict reconstruction. I think, well meaning again, that the international community go in with good intentions. But an emphasis is on infrastructures, as we had said before. But very little thought is given to the underlying causes of the conflict. It's very, very easy, and I think the concrete examples of countries that have been at war and have and very easily drift back into war situation. So a lot of times we're dealing with the results of the war, but not how the underlying causes of the war, which should integrate reconciliation between the communities, between the different groups of people in a country. I just thought I could put a spin on that. Thanks.
We turn it back over to Gail for some instructions on how the question period will work.
And let me just say, wow, that was terrific. I think... I love it when economists talk about economies as though there are people in them, and thank you for that. I think what we've heard is that after the chaos of crisis, we unfortunately have the chaos of the international community promoting what we may think is rehabilitation and reconstruction, but what is indeed complexity on top of complexity. But we've also heard a number of things from our panelists about what could be done and what should be done and what the solutions are. And what we would like to ask you to do is help build on this. And again, you've all got a facilitator at your table, and think about what two or three solutions, based on what you've heard, but also importantly on your own experience, and whether it's with conflict and crisis or not, could or should be developed by different sectors, whether it's government, business, NGOs, or individual citizens. And think about it this way. You know, President Clinton, at the conclusion of CGI and in the big plenaries, does the presentations for commitments, as we do here. Imagine it's the last plenary, and Bill Clinton is up there, and like me, he has to wear these glasses to read his points. But he announces a commitment that hits it out of the park to talk about taking what our speakers have talked about investing in the solutions after crisis rather than making it more complicated. What would that look like? It's all to you, and we'll rejoin you in about 30 minutes. Thank you.